Hello, this is Dan, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 11th, 2025 issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Starting off with front page article, Gaza, ceasefire begins, Israel says, as thousands return to the north. The Israeli military's announcement of a pause in fighting brought a mass movement of people heading home to Gaza City and its surroundings. By Liam Stack, Aaron Boxerman, and Bilal Shabir. Thousands of people began the long walk from the south to the north of the Gaza Strip on Friday, after the Israeli military announced a ceasefire that mediators hoped would lead to the end of the two-year war. Men carried bags, women carried young children, and older children held hands as they made their way up the dusty seaside road towards the ruins of Gaza City, where they were ordered to flee weeks ago. Some said they were heading north for the first time since the war began. Though the surroundings were bleak, the mood was jubilant. The crowds are unbelievable, said Shamik Al-Debs, who fled the south with his family last month. People are so happy, even if what they're going back to is destruction. Israel agreed early Friday morning to a ceasefire deal with Hamas, which the military said came into effect at noon. As part of the agreement, Hamas would release the remaining hostages held in Gaza in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, while Israeli troops would partially withdraw. The deal was based on a proposal presented by President Trump last week. On Friday, a spokesman for Israel's parliament said Mr. Trump was expected to visit the Chamber of Jerusalem on Monday. Steve Witkoff, Mr. Trump's Mideast envoy, said the U.S. military had verified that Israeli troops had withdrawn to the agreed-upon line inside Gaza. That, he said on social media, opened a 72-hour window in which Hamas must hand over the remaining hostages. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said in a recorded statement on Friday that the ceasefire deal would allow the country to bring back the remaining hostages while maintaining its forces in Gaza. Israel would not compromise on the rest of its demands, he added, including that Hamas lay down its weapons and that Gaza be demilitarized. But Hamas regards disarmament as tantamount to surrender and views armed struggle as a legitimate form of resistance against Israeli control over Palestinian lands. If this is achieved the easy way, so much the better. If not, it will be done the hard way, Mr. Netanyahu said. On the coastal road in Gaza, Musa Rajab, 22, a nursing student, said he and his cousin had decided to start walking to Gaza City as soon as they heard about the ceasefire. Around them, thousands of pedestrians shared the asphalt with trucks, vans, and horse-drawn carts packed with people and piled high with blankets, water tanks, and mattresses. We just want to see if our homes are still standing, Mr. Rajab said. We heard ours was partly damaged, but we have to see it with our own eyes. Though previous ceasefires in Gaza have collapsed into renewed fighting, Mr. Rajab was optimistic the war might actually be over this time. Everything still feels uncertain, he said. Will they tell us to leave again? I hope not. I just want this to be the last time we walk this road. Mohammed Zaki Al-Kabariti, age 43, was walking north with his nephew clutching a jerry can of water in one hand and several bags of blankets in the other. When he heard his neighbors were heading back to Gaza City, he made a snap decision to join them. He was eager to see how his neighborhood, Al-Rimal, had fared during the Israeli ground assault that began last month. I'm tired and broke, he said, but it feels like I'm going home, back to my street, my neighbors, my life. Avishai Adre, a military spokesman, said on Friday that the Israeli military would allow Palestinians in southern Gaza to travel along major roads to the north, but he warned people not to approach several areas across Gaza where Israeli troops would remain active, saying those places were extremely dangerous. On Thursday night, the U.S. military said it had struck a site in northern Gaza, which it said was being used by Hamas fighters who posed an immediate threat to Israeli troops. Gaza's Civil Defense Emergency Rescue Service said the site was a residential building that dozens of people were believed to be in at the time of the strike. According to a government resolution Mr. Netanyahu's office released on Friday, the Israeli military would have to move to new deployment lines inside Gaza by early Saturday. Hamas would then have 72 hours to return all of the hostages, including the bodies of those who have died. The text also said Israel had authorized the release of 250 Palestinian prisoners, mostly serving life sentences, and 1,722 Gazans detained during the war who were not involved in the attacks of October 7, 2023, including 22 people who were under the age of 18. On Friday, the Israeli government issued a list of prisoners who would be released, many who were convicted of staging attacks against Israelis. It did not include several high-profile prisoners whose release analysts had expected Hamas would try to secure. A Hamas office that handles prisoners' affairs said on Friday that the list was not yet agreed on or finalized. Continuing on with the front page of the New York Times from October 11th, Trump says federal layoffs have begun during government shutdown. The head of the White House Budget Office said on Friday that reductions in force had started. And there's a picture of Russell T. Voigt, the White House budget director, appearing to walk somewhere, said in a social media post on Friday that layoffs of federal workers had begun. This article by Tony Rahm, reported from Washington, October 10th. President Trump said on Friday that his administration had started a new round of federal layoffs as he seized the government shutdown to call the civil workforce and pressure Democrats into accepting his fiscal demands. The layoffs appear to target more than 4,000 employees across seven major federal departments, including, according to the administration, which revealed its plan in a filing to a federal court that is considered the legality of the cuts. That filing also hinted at the possibility of additional dismissals if the closure in Washington continues. And further on down, we have a breakdown of the number of shutdown layoffs. We have Treasury leading the list with 1,446. Health and Human Services coming in second with about 1,200, Education with 466, Housing and Urban Development with 442, Commerce with 315, Energy with 187, and Homeland Security with 176. The Trump administration said it targeted more than 1,400 employees at the Treasury Department and nearly 1,200 employees at the Department of Health and Human Services, where notices started to reach some workers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention by late Friday. The administration also proceeds with layoffs at the Commerce Department, the Education Department, the Energy Department, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, according to the court filing, which indicated that the cuts may at many of these agencies would range into the hundreds. By seeking to oust civil servants during a shutdown, Mr. Trump risked a costly escalation and a fiscal stalemate that has no end in sight. Speaking in the Oval Office on Friday, President blamed Democrats as he estimated that a lot of workers would be affected and asserted the layoffs would be Democrat-oriented. The comments illustrated anew the ways in which Mr. Trump has come to embrace the shutdown as a political opportunity, one that may allow him to rearrange the federal budget and exact revenge on his enemies. He has also halted tens of billions of dollars in federal aid to cities and states run by Democrats, while party leaders in Washington refused to fund the government absent a deal to extend a set of expiring health insurance subsidies. Unions representing federal workers quickly denounced the attempt at firings as illegal and blasted the Trump administration for trying to use the government's workforce as a bargaining chip in a political feud. The labor groups, which had sued to block the layoffs before the shutdown began, urged a federal judge on Friday to render a decision swiftly. Quote, "It is disgraceful that the Trump administration has used the government shutdown as an excuse to illegally fire thousands of workers who provide critical services to communities across the country," said Everett Kelly, the national president of the American Federation of Government Employees, one of the unions suing the administration. Under its published guidelines, the government typically must give workers 60 days notice before a layoff, though the timeline may be reduced to 30 days in certain exceptions. In some cases, though, it was not clear whether federal agencies had sent layoff notices on Friday to specific employees or whether they had rather identified programs and offices that they would look to cut soon. Many Democrats and even one Republican, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, the chamber's lead appropriator, condemned the administration for the timing and scope of its attempted firings. In a statement, Ms. Collins blamed Democrats for the shutdown but said that laying off federal workers could, quote, cause harm to families in Maine and throughout our country. Regardless of whether federal employees have been working without pay or have been furloughed, their work is incredibly important to serving the public, she said. The administration's renewed threats capped a day of confusion and fear for many federal workers, hundreds of thousands of whom are already furloughed and still others who must continue to work without pay. Mr. Trump's planned layoffs could further decimate that civilian workforce, which is already expected to employ 300,000 fewer people by the end of December compared with January, officials have said. The staggering decline is a direct result of Mr. Trump, who has presided over an aggressive and legally contested effort to shrink the bureaucracy, including through mass layoffs and induced retirements. Throughout the day, the White House repeatedly declined to answer questions about the strategy, scope, and timing of any planned cuts. Russell T. Voigt, the White House budget director, said only in a social media post that the rifts have begun, referring to the reduction in force notices to federal employees about pending dismissals. That left federal workers to piece together the fate of their own jobs, when many may not even have access to their government email. At the Environmental Protection Agency, employees received notice that a round of layoffs would soon arrive. A message reviewed by the New York Times from Stephen Cook, the principal deputy assistant administrator of the EPA's Office of Land and Emergency Management, said employees there and in two other offices would learn within 60 days whether they would lose their jobs. Officials at the Department of Homeland Security confirmed that the terminations would fall on the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which helps protect against threats to the country's election system, power grids, and water utilities. And the Education Department, a major target of Mr. Trump's cuts to date, appeared poised to shed workers at its Office of Elementary and Secondary Education, according to union leaders. The planned layoffs there, like many on Friday, appeared to mirror the sort of changes that Mr. Trump had envisioned as part of his 2026 budget submission to Congress. The White House first telegraphed that it would pursue layoffs during the shutdown before the fiscal stalemate even began on October 1st. In a memo last month, the president's budget aides essentially argued that a lapse in funding would mean that the government no longer needed to retain some of its workers. The Trump administration even appeared to issue guidance that allowed officials producing termination notices to work throughout the federal stoppage, a status typically reserved for the most vital employees, including military service and members. Unions officials later contested these actions in federal court, arguing that they were a violation of federal law, which restricts the government during a shutdown to select activities meant to protect life and national security. This week, a judge in that case ordered the Trump administration to respond by Friday evening, at which point the government unfurled the additional details about its layoff plans. An initial hearing is scheduled on Wednesday. In their reply, lawyers for the Trump administration defended the president's power to conduct the mass federal terminations, but they also issued a veiled threat, noting that these and other agencies are considering whether to conduct additional layoffs in the coming days. Unions responded hours later, telling the court that they had evidence to believe that the Trump administration had misled the court over the timing and scope of its layoffs. Labor groups said they had evidence showing that the Department of Health and Human Services in particular is, quote, requiring its employees to work over the weekend to send layoff notices at the CDC. Mr. Trump's pursuit of mass layoffs seemed only to widen the political chasm between the White House and congressional Democrats, possibly prolonging a shutdown with lawmakers having left Washington for the weekend. Let's be blunt. Nobody's forcing Trump and vote to do this, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the minority leader, said in a statement. They don't have to do it. They want to. They're callously choosing to hurt people. The workers who protect our country, inspect our food, respond when disasters strike. This is deliberate chaos. Democrats continue to reject a Republican plan to reopen federal agencies into next month as they seek to extend a set of expiring subsidies that help millions of Americans afford health insurance. Many Democrats have expressed fear that Mr. Trump would not honor any spending deal that they struck, given the myriad ways that the president has tried to circumvent Congress to rearrange the budget. I think, to their credit, the White House has now for 10 days laid off doing anything in hopes that enough Senate Democrats would come to their senses and do the right thing and fund the government, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the majority leader, told reporters early on Friday. But, he added, that could soon change. That's what a shutdown does, Mr. Thune said. You put the administration and this presidency in a position where you have to make some hard decisions. Reporting was contributed by Katie Edmondson, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Madeline Nago, Sarah Mervosh, Eileen Sullivan, Lisa Friedman, and Alan Rappaport. Tony Rahm is a reporter covering economic policy and the Trump administration for The Times, based in Washington. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing with more national news, Trump's energy cuts punished mostly blue states. Red states might be next. As New York and other states tally the damage, a leaked document suggests more Energy Department cuts may be coming. By Maxine Joslow and Brad Plumer. The Energy Department's cancellation of $7.5 billion in Biden-era awards for clean energy projects is poised to cause significant job losses and disruptions, leaders of several states have said, even as internal documents suggest that the agency may be contemplating deeper cuts in the months ahead. The agency's termination of more than two dozen grants in New York State alone would threaten more than 1,000 jobs and nearly $500 million in investments in the state, according to figures compiled by the Office of Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, and reviewed by the New York Times. The New York figures represent the first official tally of how the funding cuts, which so far have largely targeted Democratic-led states, would affect the state and its growing clean energy sector. They come as President Trump appears to be seeking to maximize the pain of the government shutdown for his political opponents, including Senator Chuck Schumer of New York and the Democratic leader, and Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, the House Minority Leader. At the same time, many lawmakers and companies fear that the Energy Department could soon cancel even more funding, including for projects in Republican-led states. An internal document circulating among lobbyists and lawmakers suggests that the agency is considering terminating an additional $12 billion in Biden-era awards, including funding for two large projects in Louisiana and Texas that aim to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Technology that removes carbon dioxide, a main driver of global warming, is supported by some oil and gas companies that want to use that captured gas to extract more crude from mature oil fields. One of the federal hubs would have been located in the Louisiana district of Representative Mike Johnson, the Republican House Speaker. The Energy Department said on Wednesday it had not made any final decisions beyond the initial $7.5 billion in cancellations announced last week. The department continues to conduct an individualized and thorough review of financial awards made by the previous administration. Ben Dieterich, a spokesman for the Energy Department, wrote in an email, "No determinations have been made other than what has been previously announced. Any reporting suggesting otherwise is false. In New York, most of the canceled funding would have gone toward Democratic congressional districts, but some of the money would have benefited Republican districts in the blue state, including those of Representatives Nick Langworthy and Mike Lawler." By refusing to stand up to Trump, New York Republicans in Congress are stabbing their own constituents in the back, Ms. Hochul said in a statement. Instead of celebrating the opening of a local factory or congratulating a neighbor on their new six-figure job, these Congress members would rather stand idly by as Trump strips their communities of 21st century economic opportunity. The Energy Department had awarded more than $26 million to two companies in Mr. Lawler's Hudson Valley District, including a company developing advanced batteries. "I'm in New York and I'm a Republican, and obviously this project cancellation impacts my district, so it's not just Democrats getting impacted," Mr. Lawler told CNN. A spokesman for Mr. Lawler, Ciro Riccardi, blamed Democrats for the shutdown. "None of this would be happening if Senator Schumer and his caucus hadn't shut down the government at the behest of Hakeem Jeffries," he wrote in an email. In the Central New York District of Representative John Manion, a Democrat, a factory that makes parts for electric heat pumps may no longer pursue a $25 million expansion after the Energy Department canceled a $5 million grant to help pay for the project. The expansion of the Bitzer Scroll plant would have added a new assembly line, initially creating 20 jobs. "The whole thing of Trump bringing jobs back to America is completely running in reverse for us," John Alcott, vice president of North American operations for Bitzer Scroll, told the local media outlet Syracuse.com. "It's just killing us." For months, political appointees at the Energy Department have been reviewing billions of dollars worth of climate and infrastructure spending that had been awarded by the Biden administration, claiming that the money was rushed out the door but providing few details about specific problems. In recent weeks, the Energy Department sent the White House's Office of Management and Budget a list of roughly $23 billion in funding that it had marked for potential termination, according to two people familiar with the matter who requested anonymity to describe internal documents. The Trump administration initially chose to slash a subset of those funds, about $7.5 billion, that were largely concentrated in blue states. The cuts underscored the administration's strategy of putting pressure on Democrats to accept a Republican budget bill and reopen the government. Nearly $8 billion in Green New Scam funding to fuel the left's climate agenda is being canceled, Russell T. Vogt, the White House budget director, wrote in a social media post last week. Those projects include major upgrades to electrical grids in California, Minnesota, and Oregon, efforts to reduce methane leaks from oil and gas operations in Colorado, and large hubs to produce clean-burning hydrogen fuels in California and the Pacific Northwest. This week, however, a leaked list marking an additional $12 billion in potential terminations has been circulating in Washington. It indicated that funding could be canceled for dozens of projects in Republican-led states as well. That larger list of potentially affected projects includes the five remaining clean hydrogen hubs in places like Appalachia, the Gulf Coast, the Midwest, and Texas, many of which aimed to produce hydrogen from natural gas. It would also include a variety of grants for retooling automotive factories to produce electric vehicles or to recycle lithium-ion batteries. The list of expanded targets also suggests that the Energy Department is considering axing up to $1.2 billion in awards for so-called direct air capture hubs in Louisiana and Texas. Those hubs, authorized by the 2021 Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, aim to test and scale up technology to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It is uncertain whether or when the Energy Department might go through with this additional wave of cuts, and the leaked list has set off a furious lobbying battle in Washington to save projects. Some companies that would be directly affected by the cuts said they had not heard of any final decisions. We aren't aware of a decision from the DOE and continue to productively engage with the administration in a project review, said Vikram Iyer, head of global policy at Heirloom, a company working on carbon dioxide removal and a main participant in Louisiana's direct air capture hub. Companies or universities that receive federal awards typically sign a legally binding agreement and then spend their own money on the expectation that they will be reimbursed by the government. Any recipients that have their funding axed could potentially sue the Energy Department, just as recipients from the Environmental Protection Agency have sued after the Trump administration canceled their grants. James indictment mirrors her civil case against Trump in miniature. The president and New York's attorney general accused each other of real estate fraud, but the sum involved in her case is $18,933, while millions were at stake in his. By Jonah Bromwich and Devlin Barrett. It has long been President Trump's impulse to tar his enemies with the same accusations they have lobbed at him. And his Justice Department's criminal case against the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, carries echoes of the civil fraud case she brought against him, albeit at a scale so small that most federal prosecutors would never deign to pursue it. The indictment, less than a month after Mr. Trump publicly exhorted the Justice Department to pursue Ms. James, accuses her of violating a mortgage agreement on a Virginia house she purchased in 2020 by using it as a rental property. The case is a fresh reminder of how the president has taken the Justice Department in hand and directed its prosecutorial powers toward its adversaries. Ms. James is the second of his enemies to be indicted in the past 2 weeks, after he insisted that a case be pursued. Just 5 days before the charges against Ms. James were handed up, he called her corrupt and scum on his social media platform and said she should be removed from the New York Attorney General's office. The indictment charges Ms. James with one count apiece of bank fraud and false statements to financial institutions and says that by misrepresenting her intentions for the house, she received favorable terms that would have allowed her to save $18,933 over the life of the loan. A federal case concerning such a small sum would be highly unusual, even absent the politics shadowing the charges against Ms. James, and the indictment's factual claims are likely to be disputed. A person familiar with Ms. James' housing arrangement said that the property had never been used as a rental and was occupied by Ms. James' family members. There was no rental agreement, and Ms. James has continued to pay the mortgage, said the person, who was not authorized to speak publicly. Ms. James is set to appear in a Virginia court on October 24th. It is likely that she will seek to persuade a judge to dismiss the charges before a trial, arguing that they stem from a vindictive and selective prosecution. But the stakes are high. If convicted, Ms. James faces the possibility of decades in prison. In a statement, a lawyer for Ms. James, Abby D. Lowell, said that Ms. James, quote, flatly and forcefully denies these charges. We are deeply concerned that this case is driven by President Trump's desire for revenge, he wrote. When a president can publicly direct charges to be filed against someone, when it was reported that career attorneys concluded none were warranted, it marks a serious attack on the rule of law. The immediate circumstances surrounding the indictment of Ms. James on Thursday were unusual in several respects. The case, which was brought in the Eastern District of Virginia, is expected to proceed in Norfolk, but was presented before a grand jury in Alexandria, just outside Washington, D.C. Like the Trump Justice Department's case against the former FBI Director James B. Comey, another nemesis of the president, it was brought by Lindsey Halligan, a former personal lawyer to Mr. Trump with no prior experience as a prosecutor. The president pushed out Ms. Halligan's predecessor, Eric S. Siebert, for expressing skepticism about cases against Ms. James and for Mr. Comey. Also, like the Comey case, Ms. Halligan was the only prosecutor whose name appeared on the indictment. In most cases, the rank-and-file prosecutors who handled the investigation signed the court filings. In recent weeks, career prosecutors in the Norfolk Division of the U.S. Attorney's Office had looked at the evidence against Ms. James and believed it did not merit criminal charges, according to people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe an ongoing case. A senior prosecutor in that division relayed that determination to her superiors, according to the people. Despite that, Ms. Halligan chose to proceed. As Ms. James knows firsthand, even civil fraud cases, which have a lower burden of proof than criminal cases, can be difficult to win. Though she initially triumphed in the civil fraud trial of Mr. Trump, which was overseen by a New York judge, a state appellate court recently threw out the $500 million penalty. The appeals panel reached a shaky agreement to uphold the finding that Mr. Trump was liable for fraud, but only so that the entire case could be evaluated by the state's highest court. Still, Mr. Trump was humiliated by Ms. James' lawsuit and the subsequent trial, which took him at one of his most prized assets, his public image as a self-made billionaire. Ms. James accused him of a years-long pattern of exaggerating his net worth on annual financial statements in order to receive favorable loan terms from bankers and insurers. Her case was years in the making. When Ms. James ran to be New York Attorney General in 2018, she pledged to investigate Mr. Trump and his family business. One of her refrains was, "No one is above the law." Since she was elected, and the following year opened an inquiry into Mr. Trump's predicated on congressional testimony from his former fixer, Michael D. Cohen. In 2022, Ms. James sued Mr. Trump, accusing him of inflating his net worth by billions of dollars. And the following year, she took him to trial, where the value of individual properties in his empire, many of them worth multiples of what Ms. James is accused of retaining in ill-gotten gains, was closely scrutinized. Both Ms. James and Mr. Trump attended the trial regularly, sitting just feet from one another. Mr. Trump pledged revenge before the case even reached a conclusion. In January 2024, he took over the microphone during the fraud trial's closing arguments and fumed at Ms. James directly, saying that her case was in fact a fraud on me. Ms. James, he said, should pay me for what we had to go through. In April, Bill Pulte, the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, initiated the case against Ms. James. He sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department, suggesting that the New York Attorney General appeared to have falsified records and indicated that she might have committed mortgage fraud. Mr. Pulte has since targeted other enemies of Mr. Trump with similar allegations, but the accusations against Ms. James are the first to make their way into an indictment. Mr. Pulte celebrated on Thursday evening, promoting a social media post that said, "Bill Pulte doesn't play. They all thought their mortgage scams were safe. They were wrong. This is just the beginning." Ms. Halligan, the U.S. attorney who secured the indictment, issued her own statement. It began with a familiar phrase, "No one is above the law." An Irish factory town prospered with China. Now its jewel in the crown is leaving. China's baby boom enriched a small Irish town where a Nestle factory made formula for Chinese newborns. Then a baby bust unraveled it all, or so it seemed. The Pout by Alexandra Stevenson. The powder was so lucrative that some people here called it cocaine. The men and women making pricey infant formula for Chinese babies at a factory in Askeaton, a small town in the southwestern Irish county of Limerick, had helped to turn around the fortunes of a place long overlooked. So when the people in suits unexpectedly arrived from Switzerland 2 years ago to deliver a death blow to the more than 540 workers employed at the plant, The first reaction was disbelief. No one could believe that Nestle, a multinational food giant, would simply shutter a sophisticated plant into which it had invested hundreds of millions of dollars. All of a sudden, the factory looked drab, said Carmel Ryan, the unofficial town historian who runs the Askeaton tourist office and whose husband, Michael, worked at the factory for 34 years before retiring. It was like the sunlight was gone from behind it. It's not hard to find someone in this town of 1,100 who worked at the plant or has a story to share about a friend or relative who was laid off. The factory was such a large presence that when a baby was born, tins of milk powder would appear on the doorstep, a gift from a neighbor working there. From the banks of the Deal River in the center of town, the factory, originally built in 1974 and passing through various owners before Nestle acquired it, looked like a lumpy green mass on the horizon. But people in town considered it one of the best places in Ireland to work. The jobs at the factory were so stable that the local credit union needed only a worker's most recent payslip to step up to give out a loan. Then came the Nestle announcement. After the swarm of local reporters filled their notebooks with stories of the job losses to come, and the national television crews packed up their vans, the initial shock gave way to suspicion. Nestle had blamed waning demand for its baby formula products in China, where the birth rate was plummeting, for the factory closure. It cited a drastic fall in births to 9 million in 2023 from 18 million in 2016. I'd like to pause here for a moment just to remind you that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. So few people were having babies in China that its population had begun to shrink, and this plant closure was an example of how that decline was reverberating around the world. But still, people had questions. Was there something else to the story? I can't believe the story as it's presented, said Kevin Sheehan, who was the longest-serving councillor in the county of Limerick until he retired from public office last year. There's a piece missing in that jigsaw. People began talking. Did the closure have more to do with the demand from China to move the factory closer to its consumers? Residents of Askeaton really recalled feeling uneasy years ago about Nestle's strategic shift to go all in on China, closing off the many markets in Europe and the Middle East it had supplied baby formula to for decades. All our eggs were in one basket, said Oliver Scanlon, age 63, a farmer, who worked at the factory for 40 years before he left several years ago. And yet the factory saw its best days when it was selling only to China. They called it the jewel in the crown, Mr. Scanlon said. Looking back, people in Askeaton say there were signs that China wasn't just interested in buying their baby formula, but also in learning every step in how it was made. Workers swapped stories about the Chinese auditors who visited every year, asking detailed questions about each process in the plant. They came and they picked up on the smallest things, observed Jimmy O'Donohue, 63, who worked as a general operator at the plant for 30 years. Tim Hanley remembers well when a group from China showed up at his dairy farm down the road from the plant around 8 years ago. Members of the group told him they were doing research, though he thought they might have been potential buyers of the plant. It was an alarm bell ringing, you know, said Mr. Hanley, 50, whose 200 cows supply milk that would eventually end up at the plant. In fairness to the Chinese, he added, they can produce everything themselves, you know. Self-sufficiency is what they're all about. So they come, they learn, they take their trade back home. For years, foreign brands clamored to get into China to sell their milk, cars, and luxury items, seeing only the possibility of 1.4 billion customers. After a tainted milk scandal in 2008 shocked the nation, even Chinese families with limited income were willing to pay more for foreign baby milk powder than families in other regions like Europe. But doing business in China can come at a steep cost, including the transfer of know-how that is ultimately felt by workers back home. At the time of its closure announcement, Nestle said that it planned to transfer production that had been done in Askeaton to facilities in Switzerland and China. Workers at the plant started leaving in waves as the company slowly negotiated its way through pay packages. A month after it said it would close the Irish plant in November 2023, Nestle said it had won approval for a factory in Suzhou in eastern China to make and sell a similar product to what it had been making in Askeaton. After warning about the falling birth rate, Nestle has since been more cheerful about the China market, saying it, quote, remains the world's largest because of the sheer number of newborns. All of this has left people in Askeaton feeling raw, though ultimately the reasons behind the closure matter less to the people of Askeaton than how it will reverberate. The last batch of milk powder was made at the plant last month. Unless someone decides to buy the plant from Nestle, which is selling it for 22 million euros, or about $26 million, the factory doors will shut for the last time in March. In a statement, Nestle said that since announcing its proposal to close the factory in 2023, supporting our employees has been our priority, adding that it has provided training and assistance to help them find new jobs. Driving through Askeaton, it's impossible to miss T.S. Moran, a brightly colored hardware store. Inside, Sean Moran, 56, stacks the shelves with television remote controls, microwaves, and hair dryers, and hopes he can keep the lights on in the shop that has been in his family for three generations. I think it's going to hit, said Mr. Moran about the factory closure. He recalled leaving Ireland in the 1980s to look for work because there were so few opportunities at home. People won't have the money to do what they want to do as often as they would like, he said. But times are not as tough anymore, he said, and people will find a way. Some of the younger workers at the Nestle factory have found new jobs at nearby plants owned by the multinational pharmaceutical companies Regeneron and Eli Lilly. Still across the street at the local credit union, employees are on alert. When times were flush, if you worked at the factory, you were guaranteed a loan, said Patrick Ranahan, a business development executive at the credit union. Now, he explained, it's definitely harder to get that over the line. There were good wages, which meant that the town flourished, said Mr. Ranahan, who remembered his mother receiving tins of baby food from neighbors when he was young. But, he added, there was always the possibility that it could be yanked away at any second. Alexandra Stevenson is the Shanghai bureau chief for the Times, reporting on China's economy and society. Clark Olofsson, age 78, dies. Bank robber helped inspire Stockholm syndrome. In a 1973 heist, he and another man held hostages who surprisingly came to defend them, drawing attention to a puzzling psychological phenomenon. Nothing about the holdup of a Stockholm bank in 1973 followed any expected storyline. Firing shots into the ceiling and shouting in English, "The party starts!" An ex-convict named Jan Erik Olsen seized three bank employees, all women, as hostages. The police swarmed in and the media descended, broadcasting the standoff live. Mr. Olsen hadn't come just to rob the bank. He was demanding that a former cellmate of his, Clark Olsen, be sprung from prison and brought to join him. Sweden's Minister of Justice went along. Even more unexpected, over 6 days of captivity, the hostages, the women, were joined by a man found hiding in the bank's vault, began defending their captors and turning hostile toward the would-be police rescuers. One hostage, Kristen Enmark, 23, speaking by phone to Sweden's Prime Minister Olof Palme, begged to be allowed to leave the bank in a getaway car with her abductors. "I fully trust Clark and the robber," she told Mr. Palme. "They haven't done a thing to us." She added, "Believe it or not, we've had a really nice time here." The police finally broke through the roof and subdued the robbers with tear gas. At trial, the hostages refused to testify against their captors. Their ordeal gave rise to a new term in pop psychology, Stockholm syndrome, to explain how victims supposedly identify and empathize with their captors rather than authorities trying to help them. Mr. Olofsson, who in Swedish media and in pop culture was portrayed as a charismatic figure, and whose lifetime of escapades on the wrong side of the law made him one of his country's most famous criminals, died on June 24th at 78. His death at a hospital in Arvika, Sweden, west of Stockholm, was not widely reported at the time. The Swedish newspaper Dagens ETC reported that Mr. Olofsson's family confirmed the death without specifying the cause, saying only that he had been treated with a long illness. He had spent more than half his life behind bars for robberies, prison breaks, and drug smuggling. He was set free for the final time in 2018. Whether Stockholm Syndrome is a veritable psychological phenomenon has been debated since its namesake drama, which took place at Creditbanken in Stockholm's Normalstorg Square in August 1973. It was first called Normalstorg Syndrome. The term was coined by a Swedish police psychologist, Niels Bergerot, after he was asked to assess the hostage's curious behavior during the robbery. But Stockholm Syndrome has never been included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the Handbook of Mental Illness in the United States. Some psychologists have explained the behavior as a coping mechanism seen in victims of kidnappings and among hostages seized by Middle East terrorists, and in victims of domestic abuse. The captives, psychologists say, find a way to self-preservation by siding with their all-powerful captors. The term gained popular currency after the kidnapping of heiress Patty Hearst by radical leftists in 1974, when Miss Hearst, after months in captivity, denounced her rich family and participated in a bank robbery with her abductors, self-styled revolutionaries calling themselves the Symbionese Liberation Army. A year later, the phenomenon was highlighted in Sidney Lumet's movie Dog Day Afternoon, starring Al Pacino, in which hostages during a bank holdup developed a bond with their captors, an event inspired by a real-life attempt heist in Brooklyn. Miss Enmark, the Stockholm hostage, spent years denying that she had ever empathized with Mr. Olsen and Mr. Olofsson. She accused the police who laid siege to the bank of incompetency. She called Stockholm Syndrome a myth, saying she had done what was necessary to stay alive. "It's a way of blaming the victim," she told the BBC podcast in 2021. "I did what I could to survive." Clark Olderth Olofsson was born on February 1, 1947 in Trollhättan, Sweden. His parents had a chaotic relationship and he was placed in foster care at 8 years old, according to accounts in the Swedish media. He grew up to become a repeat offender. At the time of his 1973 hostage drama, he was serving a sentence on robbery and weapons charges. Convicted for his role in the botched robbery of Creditbanken, Mr. Olofsson was handed another sentence of 6.5 years, but the conviction was overturned on appeal. Mr. Olofsson had argued that he had acted to protect the hostages. In 1975, while serving out his prior sentence, he escaped from prison in Norrköping, Sweden. During a year on the lam, he sailed the Mediterranean Sea, met a teenager on a train whom he would later marry, and robbed a bank in Gothenburg, Sweden, before being caught the same day. The 930,000 kroner, or about $230,000 reported stolen, was never recovered, and it set off a treasure hunt by both the police and civilians. Sentenced to 9 years for that robbery, Mr. Olofsson studied journalism behind bars and was released in 1983. The next year, he was convicted on drug charges and sent back to prison until 1991. He cycled in and out of prisons in Sweden and Denmark on drug smuggling convictions for decades, with many of his cases covered in the tabloid media. He married the young woman he had met on the train, Marijke Demunjek, in 1976, and had 3 sons with her. Complete information on his survivors was not immediately available. Mr. Olofsson's history of bank robberies, prison escapes, and shootouts with the authorities was fodder for a 2003 Swedish television film, Normalmstorg, and a 2022 Netflix series, Clark, with Mr. Olofsson played by Bill Skarsgård. Although mental health experts have theorized about Stockholm Syndrome for half a century, almost none thought to speak to Miss Enmark, the bank employee central to the drama and the diagnosis. One psychologist who did was Alan Wade, a Canadian therapist specializing in interpersonal violence, who, after meeting Miss Enmark, called Stockholm Syndrome a made-up concept meant to shift focus from the stumbles of the Swedish police. "The whole notion was an accusation," he told the BBC in 2021. "It was a way to dismiss what an incredibly heroic woman had been doing for 6.5 days to resist, preserve her dignity, and look after the other hostages. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Alex Jones asks Supreme Court to halt $1.4 billion payment to Sandy Hook families. A judge ordered Jones to pay as a result of a defamation lawsuit that he is now asking the Supreme Court to review. By Anne E. Marimau. Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and founder of InfoWars, asked the Supreme Court on Thursday to put on hold $1.4 billion in damages a judge ordered him to pay some of the families who lost children in a shooting in 2012 at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The families were awarded the money after suing Mr. Jones for defamation. For years on his InfoWars show and website, Mr. Jones falsely claimed that the shooting was a hoax and that family members of the victims were actors in a plot to enact extreme gun control legislation. 20 children, all of them first graders, and 6 educators died in the shooting. The request to the justices is the latest development in the long-running litigation, and as Mr. Jones seeks to put off any payout to the families. Mr. Jones and his company, Free Speech Systems, have separately asked the Supreme Court to review his appeal in the case. At their closed door conference on Friday, the justices will consider whether to take the case. Mr. Jones's lawyers told the justices that he should be afforded special amendment considerations because of his large audience of viewers and listeners. Failure to reverse this case will mean all journalists will realize that they could be found liable for huge defamation awards, especially in ideologically divergent geographic regions, as Jones was, and therefore refrain from the publishing for fear of being hauled into court there facing trial by sanction, his lawyers told the court in their Thursday filing. During the defamation trial in Connecticut, the families showed that Mr. Jones ignored demands to stop airing falsehoods about the Sandy Hook shooting because they increased InfoWars sales. Witnesses shared stories of harassment by conspiracy theorists who believed Mr. Jones' lies, including death and rape threats. The Sandy Hook families were awarded damages in the Connecticut case in late 2022 and in a separate defamation lawsuit in Texas earlier that year. Mr. Jones and his business declared bankruptcy shortly afterward, and the families have yet to receive any of the money awarded them. SNL trots out Amy Poehler and Tina Fey for a Senate judiciary grilling. Now it truly has been 50 years since the show's debut, and that was celebrated with a few more surprises, including cameos by Charlie XCX and Seth Meyers. By David Itzkoff. On the occasion of the actual 50th anniversary of the first broadcast of Saturday Night Live, the show turned back the clock this week with an opening sketch that featured its former cast members Amy Poehler and Tina Fey. Poehler, who was hosting this week's show, played Attorney General Pam Bondi in a sketch lampooning her testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee, while Fey made a surprise appearance as the Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Kicking off her remarks, Poehler declared to the committee, "What's up, nerds? Furious to be here." Asked if she would affirm her testimony was the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, Poehler gave a derisive laugh and said, "No." She explained that she spelled Bondi with an I because I ain't gonna answer any questions, and said that the Justice Department had many ongoing operations, moving like Cash Patel's eyeballs, very quickly in multiple directions at once. Poehler went on to roast various members of the Senate, including Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, played by Mikey Day. "Even people in Connecticut go, damn, that guy's white as hell," she said. Asked why U.S. troops were needed to protect immigration customs enforcement facilities, Poehler deferred to Noem, played by Fey, who burst into the hearing at the mention of her name, armed with a large automatic weapon. "Hold my gun," she said, tossing it off camera. Fey said that she spelled the name Kristi with an I because that's how I thought it was spelled. She added that she was the rarest type of person in Washington, D.C., a brunette that Donald Trump listens to. Told by Day that Democrats were more eager than Republicans to end the government shutdown, Fey said, "Ha, that makes me laugh more than the end of old Yeller." "When the dog gets shot?" Day asked, horrified. She replied, "Dogs don't just get shot. Heroes shoot them." After Fey gave an impromptu recruitment ad for ICE, "Do you like to use zip ties because people in your life don't trust you with keys?" Poehler said to the committee, "Does that answer your question?" Jeremy Cullen, playing Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat of Rhode Island, replied, "No, not even a little bit." "Then our work is done here," Poehler said. Opening monologue of the week. Returning to host SNL for the first time since 2015, when she and Fey were co-hosts, Poehler got nostalgic about her years in the cast, saying it was at the show that she said she found her first love, being famous. She added, "I'm still on some of the amazing medications they put me on, so I will be forever grateful." Poehler said that as a child, she would watch SNL and dream of becoming an actress one day, at least until they invent an AI actress who's funnier and willing to do full frontal. "But what's special about the age of 50," she said, "is that you start to not care about what people think. And that's what's so great about SNL," Poehler said. She's obviously stopped caring. Commercial parodies of the week. Supported Poehler, her former co-star on the NBC sitcom Parks and Recreation, Aubrey Plaza, popped up in a fake trailer for a new season of the steamy Netflix drama The Hunting Wives, where everyone is free to seduce and make out with everyone else, at least until Plaza's character reveals that she has a girlfriend and the other wives pull their guns on her. Or, if you prefer the classic style of the SNL parodies touting non-existent products, there's also the Ersatz commercial for non-alcoholic beer, the first non-alcoholic beverage that's over 96% alcohol. Cheers. Weekend update jokes of the week. Over at the Weekend Update desk, Colin Jost and his co-anchor Michael Che continued to riff on the Gaza ceasefire deal. Jost began, "It is nice to start update with some good news for once. There is peace in the Middle East. The only downside is there's war in Chicago. Only Trump could Freaky Friday Chicago and Gaza. And I know Trump is upset that he didn't win the Nobel Prize, but the last guy to send heavily armed men into an American city was Bane from Batman. Bane, who was also snubbed for the Peace Prize. And Trump deserves credit, I have to say, for brokering the ceasefire in Gaza. But I'm slightly skeptical since Biden also negotiated a ceasefire in Gaza 9 months ago. Remember that? No. Well, neither does Biden." The actual Nobel Peace Prize was awarded this week to Venezuela opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, or as Fox News reported it, Trump robbed by deranged Hispanic. Che continued, "Many leaders in the Middle East are crediting President Trump with brokering the Israeli-Hamas ceasefire. But it makes perfect sense to me, because sometimes crazy people only listen to other crazy people. Like when you see a guy jacking on the subway, you don't just ask him to stop. No, you got to take off your pet. Now we can negotiate." Okay. All right. Moving on. Opinion guest essay, "Voting for Mamdani Taught Me Why Trump Won," by Michael Hirschhorn. Mr. Hirschhorn, the chief executive of Ish Entertainment, writes about the intersection of culture and politics. "Over dinner with a politically sophisticated college friend, I explained that I was planning to vote for Zohran Mamdani for New York City mayor. In full Gen X snark mode, she asked, 'Because vibes?' She was alluding to the fact that some of Mr. Mamdani's most memeable campaign slogans are impossible as actual policy. A few are not even good ideas to begin with. Take Freeze the Rent, his rallying cry, understood to refer to the city's million or so rent-stabilized apartments. Freezing the rent has been tried. It helps in the short term, but exacerbates many long-term problems. Low-income renters would be better served by a laser focus on increasing housing supply. I'm voting for him anyway. Or take free buses. Mr. Mamdani has said little about how he'd deliver on this promise, since New York's mayor does not control the city's mass transit system, and the institutions that do are most likely to hate the idea. I'm voting for him anyway. I'm doing it because he's freaking out the business as usual power elites and driving establishment members of his own Democratic Party bananas. Because things have gone dangerously wrong in this country, and like a lot of other New Yorkers, I'm ready to tear the whole playhouse down, metaphorically speaking. That is the same spirit that motivated a great many people to vote for Donald Trump. You can see the irony. There may be no two politicians further apart on the ideological spectrum, or two who are less personally aligned. Mr. Trump has repeatedly vowed to destroy the communist, Mr. Mamdani, and beyond him, New York, if Mr. Mamdani is elected. But the appeal they make to the voters and the way voters respond is uncannily similar. Trumpism is more than politics. It's an emotional gas main explosion from people who felt unheard, patronized, left behind. The Mamdani phenomenon is a pressure valve, too, an outlet for voters to make a statement against the Democratic burghers who claim to represent the people, but who are compromised by PAC money and conventional thinking. The entire political establishment should be scrambled to adopt the lessons of these two men's candidacies. Instead, many of its members seem to be assiduously ignoring them. Kamala Harris, now on a finally free-to-be-me truth-telling book tour, recently endorsed Mamdani in the most tepid way possible. As far as I'm concerned, he's the Democratic nominee, and he should be supported, before lauding candidates running elsewhere in the country. Politicians, stop talking this way." In a recent essay bringing a survey to a gunfight, the progressive communication specialist Anat Shenker Osorio contrasts two approaches to politics. One, which she dubs pollingism, is dominant in Democratic circles. Pollingism. It assumes that voters are rational beings who make decisions based on a tempered analysis of policy. Their preferences, the argument goes, should be discerned and quantified, then duly regurgitated by politicians. The bland mush that results is increasingly maladaptive to a world dominated by social media algorithms. Prudent, temperate messages disappears into the ether. It is one reason Mikey Sherrill, the cautiously centrist Democrat candidate for governor of New Jersey, is in an even remotely close race with a Republican who is running in part on bringing back plastic shopping bags. The alternative to pollingism, Ms. Schenker Osorio writes, is magnetism, the notion that if you want people to come to your cause, you must be attractive. Magnetism contains the possibility that a candidate might change the power equation, that ideas once thought impossible, like Mr. Mamdani's push for free childcare, suddenly become plausible. Mr. Trump and Mr. Mamdani are both magnetists. People like Mitt Romney and, say, Chuck Schumer are not. Democrats have been pulling their hair out trying to figure out how to win back young men who voted for Mr. Trump in droves. In a post-primary survey of likely New York voters, Mr. Mamdani was polling at 85% among men 18 to 34. That's not just Brooklyn hipsters and aura-farming Nepo babies. It's a whole city's worth of young dudes, from small business owners in Queens to warehouse workers in the Bronx. Soon after the 2024 election, when Mr. Trump gained ground in Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's district, people on social media told her they saw no contradiction between voting for him and her. "I feel you're both outsiders compared to the rest of D.C., less establishment," one person wrote. "It's real simple," wrote another. "Trump and you care for the working class." Centrist Democrats have nonetheless insisted that Mr. Mamdani's approach would be political suicide anywhere outside New York. Do you really think, they ask, that a Democratic socialist has half a chance in Arkansas? What made Mr. Mamdani broadly popular isn't his party affiliation. It's the fact that he actually listens to New Yorkers, including those who voted for Mr. Trump. They told him what they cared about most, the insane cost of living, and he built a hyperlocal campaign around that, all while resisting Pollingism's suburban strip mall blandness. Do I think that approach would work in Arkansas? I sure do, and in Cedar Rapids or Sioux County, Iowa. Paradoxically, the one position at which mainstream Democrats seem immune to Pollingism is support of Israel's actions in Gaza. Mr. Mamdani's opposition to that has aligned him with most Democratic voters. Of course, there is more to Mr. Mamdani's appeal than his focus on the cost of living. Otherwise, the rent is too damn high guy would have been elected president by now. This is a febrile, statue-toppling time, one with some parallels to the politics of previous moments of authoritarian ascendancy when hard-left movements sprung up in response to the right. But it's not quite a horseshoe moment either. That's the theory that far-left and far-right ideologies often converge around similar ideas in times like these. As we watch Mr. Trump lay waste to the multiple generations of conservative dogma, it starts to become clear that ideology of any kind is inadequate to capture what is happening in the electorate. Perhaps it's time to turn the lens from horizontal to vertical and start looking at politics not through prism of left-right, but top-bottom, the elite versus everyone else. There is another way, however, that the horseshoe metaphor seems quite apt. Democratic sages have for eons warned progressives that we must respond sensibly to MAGA extremism. After all, it was our supposed excesses, DEI, college debt relief, campus speech codes, trans rights, that allowed the right to triumph, they say. The Mamdani phenomenon says the opposite. What is inspiring all these volunteers, some 75,000 by one count, to join his cause? I suspect it is the promise of finally going on the offensive and forcing the other side to respond. Call it vibes if you want, but they put Donald Trump in the White House and will very likely put Zohran Mamdani in Gracie Mansion. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 11th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Dan. Thank you for listening.